All right, well, this is now Friday, January 15. Can you believe it, that halfway through the first month of the year already?
Oh, I know. Oh, it seems like a long time.
Yeah, when you're an old man like me. Boy, he must be feeling his age today, because all he's talking about is how old he is. It goes quick. Anyway, so we're looking at chapter 21. We're looking at the first slide that's entitled Ribulose 1,5-Bis Phosphate, the carbon dioxide acceptor, capturer of carbon dioxide. Fixation. Now, I want you to note the word fixation. When you fix, a compound, you basically trap it. And typically you trap it in the form of another compound or linked to another compound. So you hear of carbon dioxide fixation. There's also nitrogen fixation, which is also a very important process that only a limited number of materials or living organisms do. For example, a soybean is famously known for fixing nitrogen. But when they examine the exact biochemistry of it and the cell biology of it, turns out that the plant itself doesn't fix the nitrogen. It's the bacteria that live in nodules in the roots that fix the bacteria. And many years ago, before they knew about artificial fertilizers and but they knew about the nitrogen part, they would sometimes, corn was much more valuable than soybean. For many, many years, soybean was just pig feed. There was hardly any market for it until they discovered the oil in it and the protein that they could use for other animal food, and then and it just exploded. But at any rate, so they would grow corn on a field for a couple years, and then the next year they'd grow soybeans and simply plow it under to get the nitrogen and the other materials back into the soil. But they don't do that anymore. They use artificial ammonia that they capture. But at any rate, so fixation is accomplished by ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. That's the entire name of it. Also known as Rubisco, which of course immediately reminds you of the food company named Nabisco. That's correct. Probably the world's most abundant protein. Now, you could underline that, but you have to understand. If it's green and leafy, it's got Rubisco. Green and leafy. There are some bacteria that use a different mechanism, some algae, but certainly all the living plants. And so there are proteins in that plant. Yes, but in any given leaf, sometimes, and they have discovered this, that half of the protein in that leaf is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. And so that's why they probably figure it's the most abundant protein. It turns out to be the world's most important protein. Because without carbon dioxide fixation, you wouldn't have any carbohydrate. And without any carbohydrate, you wouldn't be alive. No animal would be alive. No consumer. So be grateful for Rubisco. Interestingly enough, the ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase is the appropriate enzyme function. The oxygenase is a mistake, apparently. And we'll talk about what that means in a little bit. All right, so it's activated when it gets carbamylated. That means it gets a little carbon dioxide added to a lysine, and with magnesium bound. So the concentration of magnesium within the region where Rubisco exists alters its activity. The concentration of magnesium in the region where Rubisco exists alters its activity. All right. The substrate of the enzyme is actually a feed-forward inhibitor. Okay, must be released from the inactive Rubisco by Rubisco activase, carbamylation, and magnesium then activate. So the substrate when it's not actively capturing carbon dioxide, is bound up with its substrate, and somehow that substrate has to be knocked off before the other things can activate the enzyme. It's an odd thing, odd kind of control mechanism, but it is what it is. All right, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase reaction. Now, the details of this really are beyond the scope here because we have a lot more to get to. This is an interesting thing as well. The bottom line here is right here. Note that carbon dioxide, not bicarbonate, carbon dioxide in its hydrated form, is the true substrate. So this stuff, sincerely, literally, the enzyme combining it with this substrate captures carbon dioxide out of the air, or what is dissolved in the liquid immediately adjacent to the enzyme. There's no modification required for it at all. So here you've got this high energy compound, you've got this enol carbamate, the carbon dioxide comes in, gets attacked backside by that oxygen or something, at any rate, and you end up having this carbon dioxide attached to that. Water comes in to reduce the subsequent oxygen here, and then that splits and forms two of these glycerate compounds, three phosphoglycerates. So you got a 5-carbon come in, you got a carbon added there, and it breaks in the actual mechanism to produce three carbon compounds. You will not need to memorize this. Just simply recall that Rubisco uses carbon dioxide as a dissolved gas as its one of its substrates. It's amazing. Now, what do you do with this stuff after you make it? Well, obviously, that three carbon compound is not, as you know, is not a sugar. I mean, it is a sugar, but it's not glucose. What happens is that after Rubisco occurs, there's an elaborate rearranging of these atoms to produce glucose. A set of reactions that transform 3-glycerate into hexose sugar. This is the principal carbon dioxide fixation pathway in nature. That's why we're so dependent on it. I apologize for this again, reminding you. This is why I was fairly skeptical of carbon dioxide as being a toxin in the environment or in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a natural product of oxidation. It has to exist in the atmosphere for plants to exist. I would claim that when we're burning coal and putting that plant material back in the atmosphere, we're actually effectively fertilizing the atmosphere for plants. Seriously. So evidence seems to point to the fact that carbon dioxide does not have as dramatic and catastrophic effects on the atmosphere as some would claim. All right. Well, this is basically a little bit of gluconeogenesis and a little bit of pentose phosphate pathway. Oh, my goodness, the Calvin-Benson cycle of reaction. Let's go through here. And let's see what happens. Okay. You'll recognize pieces of the pentose phosphate pathway in this, actually. The width of the diagram indicates how many of any of these things come out. All right. The number associated with the arrow in each step indicates the number of molecules reacting in a turn of cycle that produces one molecule of glucose. All right. So let's start up here with ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate. And there's the enzyme that we're all dependent on, the life-giving enzyme. If you want to claim it for the animals at least, and for plants as well, they need to fix the carbon dioxide. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase, and in parentheses, oxygenase. What you do is you come in with 6 molecules of that, and you combine it with 6 molecules of the carbon dioxide, and you then end up with 12 molecules of this 3-phosphoglycerate. It gets activated by a kinase, which makes it a diphosphate. NADPH comes in, 12 of them come in, and under the influence of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphodehydrogenase to make Glyceraldehyde, 3-phosphate. Glyceraldehyde, 3-phosphate. Now, it's very difficult to see, isn't it? Yeah. We'll just bump out of this and see what we can do about making this bigger for us. Is that actually bigger? I think it is, isn't it? Yeah. We're going to expand it like this. We're going to bring it over. And so on. We can actually make it even bigger. Let's make it 300%. And then just cycle through here. All right. So you end up making 12 of these glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates. Now, where was the last time you saw glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate? Say glycolysis, or gluconeogenesis. That's exactly right. So, 12 of them come down here, and now comes the fancy-dancy rearranging part. Apparently, you can't just take the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, hit it with some triosphosphatidylsomerase, make 6 TIMs and 6 3G3, and then make 6 glucoses. No. That, of course, would be too easy. Nature does it a little different way. And let's see where it goes. Oh, my goodness. So we got 12 of those gaps coming in. 5 of them come off to make DHAP. Another 3, let's see here, what happens? 3 of these combine with 3 of the DHAPs to make fructose. 2 of those come over and 2 of them come over and are rearranged to form, how does that go to work? Let's see here. We get We take 2 of these fructose 6-bisphosphatates, or we've got 4 of them here, or 6 of them. 6 of them? 4 of them? How many are here? Must be 3. 3 of these. That can't be right. It's got to be more than 3. No, I guess it is more than 3. But that breaks up to 6 pieces. So, two glucoses come. I don't know if we can. Maybe we should start over, and maybe we should make a bigger diagram out of this. And no, you're right. I didn't do the electron transport business. All right. Let's see. We have to go back here so we can see the whole thing. All right. Well, so we've got 5 come in here, 7 come down, 4 split off, 3 go in here. So let's keep counting the carbons. We have 5 of them come off here to make 15 carbons here. 3 of these come off. And so that's 15 and 3, which is 18. 18 making into 6 carbons. So there's actually 3 of these come here to make the fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. So we got 3 right here. We lose 3-phosphate. These 3 come down here. 2 of them go down in this direction. 1 of them comes up over here and gets made into this glucose 6-phosphate and gets made into glucose. Waha! Woohoo! Now then, what do we got? So we make 1 glucose. How many of these did it take to make that 1 glucose? Look at this. There's actually 12 of these that are made. Is that correct? And then 2 of them have been used to make glucose. Right? Because each of these are 3, right? And this is a 3 and a 3 together, so here's your glucose out of it. So 6 carbon dioxides came in, combining with 6 riboses, and that turns out to be then a total of 18 carbons. Let's see here. How many carbons is that? That would be 6 times 5 is how many? 30. And then 6 more carbons, that would be how many? 36. And so we end up with how many carbons here? Total, 36. Because, 36 carbons. Now, we end up producing a single glucose that has how many carbons in it? 6. So if we had 36 here, we removed 6, how many carbons does that leave left? 30. But what's the problem? I don't know. I appreciate your honesty, absolutely. All right. The problem is those 30 carbons are encapsulated in 10, as it were, 10 units of 3. Okay? So, in other words, at the end of this, we have 12 units of 3. Right? Would you agree with that? Well, we end up with 2 of those units making glucose. Then we've got the remaining 10 units of 3. But what do we have to start this whole process over again? 6 units of 5. So we have to, from those 10 units of 3, we've got to make 6 units of 5. Well, how do you do that? Does that make sense now?
Yes.
All right. So this entire process is basically rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. No, I mean, it's much more useful than that. But at any rate, oh my goodness, this is just, this is an enzyme soup. What do we do with this? Well, I'm not going to make you memorize this because it's beyond the scope. I mean, if you go into photochemistry or photosynthesis, this will become secondhand to you. But you end up suddenly realizing the complexity of the problem that nature is facing is that they took, 6 units of 5, combined it with 6 singles to make 12 units of 3, and then they've got to they take out one of those units, or 2 of those units, but they've got to rearrange it all so it's back to 6 units of 5. All right, well, I don't know if I want to go through this so much. All right, so let's take a look at the glucose. So we got, obviously, glucose is going to come from, you got the GAP and the DHAP, and you're familiar with that gluconeogenesis makes the fructose, and the fructose makes the fructose 1-phosphate, and then this could easily go back into glucose, and they make glucose. So what's left over then? Well, you got a bunch of you got 4 threes, you got 2 three, you got 2 threes here. So this comes down here and gets split. This transaminase gets split. And so it probably gets split what is this? What happens with this? Let's see here. It's a, what's the number of carbons that you get out of this? a 3 and, oh, I see. All right. So let's see what we got coming in here. Is this a transketolase? You got 2 coming in from here and 2 coming in from here, right? So how many carbons are coming in? This is a set of 4 that are a set of, how many, this set of 4 is how many carbons each? This broad line here, 3. Okay, there's 2 of them get peeled off. So there's 2 of 3 coming in here. There's 2 of 6. Let's see here. 2 of 3 and 2 of 6. How many carbons is that total? So 2 of 6 is 12, 2 of 3 is 6, so it's 18. 18, all right, let's see if we can figure this out. 18, where do they go? Well, we've got 2 fours coming up here, And we've got two fours coming up here. No, is that a four or a five? No, that. Let's see here. It comes down here. This is a three. See what happens is, oh, okay. All right. Let's see here. I'm going to have to sit down and do this again. I do this at one time. This is a 2. This is a 3 that comes in, combines with a 2. This 3. what I'm going to do is we're going to go on. And I'm going to, if I can remember to do it, on Wednesday, we'll go over this again. Or I will hand this out in blown up form and show you where all the carbons go. Right? So I'll make it much bigger than this thing. Okay? Is that fair enough? There's no reason for me to follow, you know, fool around and have you get all confused watching me try to figure this out again. I can't tell you how many times I've figured this out and forgotten it over the years. You know what I'm saying? If you don't use it, you lose it. Suffice it to say, however, ladies and gentlemen, that you have a complicated situation where you've got small ones coming in. This is an interesting one. I like this one. This is where it comes in. And you have a, this makes no sense to me, but it's got to. This is, there's a 4 and a 3 coming to make a 7. The 7 splits up, gets rearranged, and the 7 comes in, and 2 of them fall off, 2 of the carbons. You get this 5 carbon here. The 7 is the key. Making a 7 out of the 3s is crucial, because once you do that, you can end up having a 5 and a 2 come off, and a 2 carbon combining with the 3 carbon make another 5, and then they end up making that 5 again. So the acetoheptulose, which is very similar to the pentose phosphate pathway, is crucial. We'll review this again. All right. Now, let's quickly move on. What's going on again? What is the key chemical reaction right here? The fixation of carbon dioxide. And did you like the way I flashed the answers to you and then immediately withdrew them? You like that? how does photorespiration limit carbon dioxide fixation? This is the topic here is not answered by this thing right here. How does photorespiration limit carbon dioxide fixation? And we will talk about that. What these three ideas here is, what controls the rate of fixation of the carbon dioxide? What are the controlling factors in it? How come it occurs faster during daylight than at night, although it can occur at night? Well, the rate of reaction of Rubisco is dependent on its pH, the availability of the NADPH, and the concentration of the magnesium ion. Okay. So the enzyme Rubisco is controlled by pH, pH, which is hydrogen ion concentration, magnesium ion concentration, and then also the availability of the NADPH to activate it and so on. So that's the controlling factors in it. what happens is... What you typically find is what has to go on in a plant that's seemingly, apparently contradictory. Well, in one place in the plant, you're trying to fix carbon dioxide under the influence of light to make sugar. In another location, you're trying to take that same sugar and break it down back into carbon dioxide to provide energy at another location in the plant. Down in the roots, in the trunk and so on, where photosynthesis is not occurring. So these changes here help control nitrogen carbon dioxide fixation. So regulation of photosynthetic carbon dioxide fixation or light activation controls the net flux of carbon between these two opposing routes. So you've got a fight between respiration and synthesis. Let's take a look at what goes on here. Light-induced pH changes in chloroplast compartments. Illumination of chloroplast leads to proton pumping and pH changes in the chloroplast such that the pH within the thylakoid space falls and the pH of the stroma rises. Okay, this pH changes or modulates the activity of key Calvin enzyme spaces. So the thylakoid space and the stroma, when there's light present, the pH changes. And why is that? Can someone tell me why the pH changes in these things? Yeah, because of the proton pumps. Now, where are the protons pumping? Let's take a look at that. I'm going to escape out of here. We're going to go right near the beginning, like number 13. This is number 29 and 13, okay. Oh, that's the reaction center. That's not the one. That's not it either. Was it this one? Four? There you go. Zoom. I just won 100%. Okay. Let's go back up here. Doink. The thylakoid space is the same thing as the thylakoid lumen. Okay. So the protons are being pumped from the stroma into this yellow area, the lumen. So what's going to happen to the pH in the lumen? It's going to go down because the hydrogen goes up, hydrogen concentration, and the stroma is going to become more basic as the protons are pumped out of it. So that's why you have that particular characteristic. And dink. And dink. So the activation of these enzymes right here is dependent on the pH, as you see. And that pH changes whether it's in light or in light or if it's in the dark. Another way is that if there are reducing equivalents available, we'll activate that enzyme. Another thing is if there are reducing equivalents available, that will also act on that enzyme. And so what happens is, it says here, several Calvin cycle enzymes have paracysteine residues that are involved in disulfide transitions. And so when there's lots of reducing power available from the PS1, photosystem 1, this can reduce these disulfide bonds, which are apparently reduce their activity, and when they get reduced, they become more active. So that means when there are protons or photons being absorbed and electrons being removed from water, eventually some of these enzymes get reduced around a disulfide bond, and that activates them. That activates them so that they are active during when light is present. All right, now let's see here. So we're looking then at these Calvin cycle things, and it's best if these are activated when light is available. That's why it says here, light activates carbon dioxide fixation. And one of those reasons why it activates it is that the enzymes that are responsible for carbon dioxide fixation operate better in low pH. They also operate better when they're reduced, which means that there are electrons available from the photosynthesis system. I don't think this handout talks about the role of magnesium ion in it. But magnesium ion is pumped out the same time that protons are pumped in. And so as the magnesium concentration drops, the activity increases. So I just want to make... Okay, I've got to go back because I've got to talk to you about something that is not actually shown here. These three ideas here are actually not related to the idea up here, photorespiration. So I need for you to take a little bit and write some ideas down for me, all right? Here's the thing. And this is specifically about the Rubisco enzyme. The Rubisco enzyme is not particularly efficient. It has a turnover number of between 4 and 5 per second. 4 and 5 per second. Which is one of the reasons why, you don't need to write this down, but it was one of the reasons why there's so much of it in the plant. Is that if you're going to capture any kind of appreciable amount of carbon dioxide, you've got to have a lot of the enzymes, because any individual enzyme is not capturing much carbon dioxide. So now write this down. The active site does not exclude oxygen. The active site does not exclude oxygen. The active site can and does bind and react with oxygen. The active site can and does bind. Can and does bind with oxygen and acts on it. And it actually uses it as a substrate. This creates a futile cycle and releases carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. This creates a futile cycle and then actually releases carbon dioxide back in the atmosphere. That activity is called oxygenase. Oxygenase. That's the oxygenase part of it. And also, after oxygenase, put in photorespiration. Photorespiration. So oxygenase activity is also called photorespiration. It's the, quote, error that Rubisco does by reacting with oxygen in the place of carbon dioxide and releasing carbon dioxide. So the oxygen binds the Rubisco. The Rubisco then binds with the ribulose, and bingo, it produces, it actually begins to release carbon dioxide through a process that we are not going to get involved in because I don't remember it. Well, this is carbon dioxide. A plant releasing carbon dioxide, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a bad thing.
Yeah. If we as humans began to release oxygen, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? That would be a very bad thing. I don't even know what mechanism would be for us to release oxygen, but it wouldn't be a very good thing. Yeah, so it's a bad thing. It apparently is a fairly common activity. Including the fact it's an inefficient enzyme, it's also a fairly error-filled enzyme in which it accepts oxygen as a substrate and releases carbon dioxide. That process is known as photorespiration. As near as they can tell, photorespiration has a protective effect during intense sunlight. Imagine if you would, and you've done this, all of us have, on a hot, bright, sunny, beautiful summer day, it's just hot. And so you need to get in the shade. And where do you go?
Under a tree.
Now, let me ask this question. Can a tree escape the sunlight?
No.
It just has to sit there and take it. Okay. Just sit there and take it. Studies indicate that there is enough photo light hitting a leaf on a bright sunny day that there's not enough carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere around the leaf to absorb and fix all that carbon dioxide. I mean, it uses up all the carbon dioxide and still has all this energy coming in. And it appears that the capture of oxygen and its subsequent release of carbon dioxide protects Rubisco and the leaf from severe damage by that excess sunlight. They've done experiments like this. They've taken a leaf, you know, put it in a gas control chamber, and they allow it to grow, and they put the right amount of carbon dioxide in, and nitrogen and oxygen, everything's just fine. Then they put a different leaf in a different chamber in which there's just nitrogen and carbon dioxide. And then they put another one, which is nitrogen and oxygen, and another one in which it's just nitrogen. And they hit all those leaves with the same amount of light energy. And the leaf that has just nitrogen is almost immediately begins to be destroyed, and the chlorophyll being bleached, it turns white. So that sunlight hitting that leaf, where there's just nitrogen and oxygen, holds up better under intense sunlight than if it was just nitrogen. So there is some apparent protective effect that oxygenous activity has for the leaf. So Rubisco, without the O, would be simply Rubisc. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. But the protective nature of the oxygen absorption creates that Rubisco, the oxygenase part of it. All right, so does that make sense about what I just said there? It's a futile cycle, but apparently it has purpose. And, okay, C4 pathway for oxygen fixation. There is this C4 pathway is actually not a different pathway. It's simply an enrichment pathway. It's a CO2 delivery system which carries carbon dioxide from the oxygen-rich leaf surface to the interior cells. Oxygen won't compete in the Rubisco reaction. Oh, see? Where it won't compete. So if you could increase the carbon dioxide concentration, the efficiency of that enzyme would grow, would increase, and the effectiveness, the plant would grow faster. Did you know that there are greenhouses or nurseries that release carbon dioxide into their glass greenhouses to increase the concentration of it? So that plants will grow faster? Yes. Yes. It's an interesting, does it work? You know, I'm sure the first time they tried it, they didn't know if it did work. But it obviously must work. And it must make them money, or else they wouldn't do it. So the resulting plant growth is sufficient enough that they could sell the plants for higher value than the cost of releasing the carbon dioxide into the plant. Yes. In other words, are you like making excess glucose and you're going to have a little bit of sugar? Or what are you saying?
Well, like if you put excess nitrogen or excess fertilizer, the plant becomes weak. So like it's...
Oh, yeah. The excess nitrogen, excess fertilizer, that actually, in the soil at least, over a certain limit, that does become toxic.
But
carbon dioxide is such a benign chemical to the plant that I don't know that there is an excess amount of carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide in our atmosphere,
correct. The biosphere would fix a lot more carbon dioxide. Yeah. Just as a mental image, you've seen the natural history of the Earth. And you've seen these huge plant-eating dinosaurs, the brontosauruses and stuff. They're massive. They're 2 and 3 times bigger than the whales are, the biggest whales we have. Okay? In order for them to survive, they had to eat all the time. Tons and tons and tons of green material, right? The richest, wildest, most most fertile, most succulent, densest rainforest on the planet to this right now could not support one of those animals. There's just not enough green. So sometime in life in this Earth's history, and I would prefer to think a shorter time than a longer time ago, this planet was basically, did you ever watch Star Wars? And there was a planet that was nothing but, you know, it was entirely covered in swamp and trees and all this kind of stuff.
Are you talking about Endor?
Or is it Endor or? It was in the first one. It may have been Endor. No, it was the first one in 1976. It was episode 4. Land there, and Yoda was there because there was so much life force. There was so much life on this planet. That's the kind of density of green leafy vegetables that brontosaurus had to have. Something happened in our planet to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, because if we had the appropriate amount, it would be much more vegetatively rich. It has to be. Any rate, so and there's proof that there's been higher carbon dioxide levels and lower carbon dioxide levels and medieval warming periods and blah, 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 blah. Any rate, nevertheless, the current system is that there's a fairly low concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and I need to let you go. Can someone tell me what the minimum level of carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere for plant growth?